Well, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the City Library. I am Chris Eisenberg, Director of Philanthropy here at the Natural History Museum of Utah, and we are delighted to have you with us this evening as we present the next event in our 2017 lecture series, Food. This year, with the help and vision of four of the preeminent minds in the world of food production, we are exploring and reimagining the way we think about what's on our plates, how it gets there, who's at the table, and who's missing. I'd like to thank a number of sponsors and partners who make it possible for the museum to host a series like this each year. And if you want to just hold your applause, we'll thank everybody at the end. We are especially grateful to our founding underwriter, the R. Harold Burton Foundation, as well as our underwriter, the Cultural Vision Fund, for their tremendous and ongoing support of the series. We'd also like to thank our gold sponsor, Rio Tinto Kennecott, our silver sponsors, the Clark Foundation, the Kent C. and Martha H. DeFiore Foundation, the M. Lazy M. Foundation, and Myriad Genetics. I'd also like to acknowledge our media partner, KCPW 88.3 FM, as well as our community partners, the Viridian Center, Frog Bench Farms, Kingsbury Hall, Liberty Heights Fresh, Harmon's Neighborhood Grocer, and of course, the City Library for hosting tonight's lecture. We also greatly appreciate the voters of Salt Lake County as their approval of the Zoo Arts and Parks Fund provides invaluable support for the museum programs, as well as so many cultural opportunities across Salt Lake County. So please join me in thanking our fabulous partners and sponsors tonight. And now to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Diana Cox Foster. Dr. Cox Foster is the research leader and research entomologist at the USDA Agricultural Research Service at the Pollinating Insects Research Unit in Logan, Utah. An expert on various bee species, she has pioneered research on pollinators and the critical role they play in our delicate food system. Tonight, she will illuminate the work she and her counterparts are doing to understand and solve pollination management issues in the United States and around the world. Please join me in welcoming Diana Cox Foster.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here. And just to give you a little bit of my background, I've been at Logan a year and a half, but I'm not a stranger to the West. I grew up in Colorado. My family were pioneers. I called the Four Corners mainly home. Actually went to school in kindergarten in Monticello, so I did cross over the border into Utah. And from there went on and got my degrees in entomology and molecular biology. I ended up back east at Penn State University as a young junior faculty and stayed there for 28 years. At Penn State, I was faculty member in entomology and did work on a lot of systems, but one of them was honeybees and looking at interactions with varroa mites and the viruses. And I was one of those people that got called up when colony collapse disorder occurred, and it took over my life. And I thought I didn't live in an ivory tower, but soon discovered that that there were major issues out there. And as we move forward, I think we did help the beekeepers to some degree, but I realized that many of those bees that I grew up loving might also be having issues. So there came an opportunity to come join the Logan Bee Lab, it's a lot shorter than the Pollinating Insect Research Unit, and it's a great place. It's the only lab in the United States in the Agriculture Research Service that works on all the bee species, which includes honeybees, but all the bees that are native to the United States. So as some of you may know, honeybees are not native to the United States. They're our insect livestock. We as humans have brought them all over the world where we've gone. They've come out of Asia, Europe, and Africa, and we've distributed them everywhere, along with many of our crops. So today I'd like to tell you a little bit more about bees, what they do, how that involves food, especially those things we like to eat that are really yummy and tasty, and then why we need to be concerned. and hopefully won't be a total bummer, try to end on a high note of what you can do to help them. So, what you may not know is that there's a huge diversity in bee species out there. There's 20,000 different species globally. Many of them we still don't know and discover to add on to that number. And here in North America, there's 40,000 plus. And our lab up at Logan is the home of the U.S. pollinating insect collection. We have over 1 million different specimens in our lab. It's used mainly for research purposes to help characterize and decide who they are and where they've been and come from. We're the repository in the United States, so you need to feel proud about the having that here in Utah. My scientists, we have 7 of us now. 2 of them are systematists, basically the people going out and looking. One of them is a brand new fellow who's going to be developing molecular tools to help try to figure out who these bees are and what they're doing. And having the lab be in Logan, you can see on this why that's so important. This is showing you the diversity here in the United States. The darker the color, the browns here, that's where we have the most diversity, the incredible wealth of different species. So Utah, there's 1,087 species that we know of, and we keep adding on to it. So this might look familiar to you, being down in southern Utah. There's actually a bee that makes its home in the sandstone. It digs its hole in there. So Frank Parker used to be a research leader, initially found these holes and carved them out and brought it up to Logan. The amazing thing was that this bee doesn't just stay in there over the winter. It can stay in there for 2 years. So it's basically bed hedging, figuring out when's the ideal time to come out. If it's bad year, it can stay in until the next year. So this bee also makes its home into the ruins of the Pueblo Indians. So they called it the sandstone bee, but gave it the species name of Pueblo in honor of that. And it's found throughout the Southwest, wherever you see these blue dots here, the species have been found. Some of the other areas we still need to go and explore. So this bee, it actually digs these holes out. If you listen, I'm not getting the sound here, but it played great before we came here. Let's go back and, but anyway, over here, if you could hear it, you'd hear this little bee in there crunching and munching away. It's using its mandibles, its cuticular part of its teeth, to basically dig out those holes. And what it does in there, it digs these chambers in there, and it then brings in pollen and nectar and creates a nest in there for its baby bees. This is a solitary bee. It doesn't have a colony. It's just the one female in each of those tunnels there that it creates this. And we still don't know exactly what this bee does. What plants is it pollinating? As I'll tell you here in a little bit, there can be a specialization between the plants out there, the flowers, and their particular bee species. So we still need to go back in and figure out who this bee is pollinating and what it's doing out there. But the point is, we still have lots of bees. There you can hear, chomping away. So, the one message I want to get across tonight is that bees are extremely important in not only food supply, but also our natural environment. They're what we call a keystone species. So back in PA, Pennsylvania, I had to learn what a keystone was because we were called the Keystone State. Basically, if you have a Roman arch shaped like this, this stone at the top, this green one, is the keystone because it's wedged in there and basically supports everything. It can seem like a very insignificant part of the whole structure, but if you pulled it out and took it away, everything would collapse. And the reason why these bees are keystones is because of what they do. So we as human beings have had a very long association with honeybees. This is a ruin. It's found in Israel, right over here, Rehovot, up in this area. And it goes back about 800 years BC. And what they found in there when they dug down is this area in here. What this is an apiary right in the smack middle of the village. There are over 100 different bee colonies in there. These are traditional hives that you would find that region made out of clay cylinders. On the back side, you could pull out the door and reach in and take the comb. On the other side, the bees are in, exiting, and going about their business. So this somehow burned, and there were still fragments of bees present in there in wax. The cool thing, when they went and asked, where did those bees come from? Because these bees right here in this region are known to be really angry, mean, aggressive bees, Syrian bees, they call them. Just happened that way. The bees in these colonies came from Turkey, the Anatolian bees. It's over 500 miles away. So this is BC. To get those bees across that area, they actually had to move them around. So we were moving bees from a lacrosse distance way back then. So we've made use of bees for a long period of time. The colonists brought the bees over when they first came, crossed over in ships, introduced it, and basically took them about. So those of you who aren't familiar with honeybees, and I know there's several beekeepers here who are, inside the colony, you can think of it as being a superorganism. The individual bees, the worker bees by themselves, cannot go off and live by themselves. They have to be in the colony. In that colony, the one individual who's extremely important is the queen bee. She's the mother of all. She's the one who lays eggs. And if they're fertilized eggs, diploid, they develop into females. If they're unfertilized, they develop into males. That's the same for all the hymenoptera, the bees, ants, and wasps. The other bees, the worker bees, come in and they take care of these. These worker bees, when they emerge, take on different tasks. The first task is to serve as nurse bees. They consume all the pollen and the nectar coming in. There's the stomachs of the colony. They digest it. They make it into salivary secretions that they feed everybody. The queen bee is fed royal jelly her whole life. These other bees that become worker bees just get it for one day, and then they get what's called brood food. They go through various larval instars, grow very big, and then they spin a silken cocoon, get capped off with wax, and inside they develop as pupae. And after a period of time, a total of 21 days, they emerge as the worker bees. As that worker bee gets older, she goes from processing, doing feeding the larvae, to processing honey. Then she becomes a forager, either going out for nectar or pollen in itself, during the summer, about a 30 to 60 day lifespan. So initially, we probably liked the sugar a great deal, the honey. That was the sweetness. It's still extremely valuable in many parts of the world. But bees are more than just honey. In Utah, here is the beehive state. This is seen as great industry, and that is what we know. Bees as a whole, all the different species, have a very long-standing relationship with flowering plants. Flowering plants and bees probably exploded together back when they did speciation, and we see that they have a long-standing contract in place. For the flower, she's producing pollen and nectar to feed that bee. In return, that flower is going to get fertilized and lay a seed to allow for reproduction. For that bee, that pollen and nectar is essential food. The nectar, you can think of it as being the quick energy, so that can of sugar, candy bar, parents up here, yeah, tell your kids that. That pollen is basically everything mom told you to eat, protein, lipids, vitamins. And not all pollens are created equal. They differ from one plant to another plant in their fatty acid compositions and what they bring in. So, the other fact for the night is that nearly 90% of the flowering plant species depend upon pollinators. This includes trees. If you're back east, an ash tree, a maple tree, you don't necessarily think of those associated with bees to get seed production, but it's true. Shrubs and flowers. So much of the environment around us, besides grass, is depending upon pollinators for continued survival. In terms of food, we see that 3/4 of the top global food crops around the world depend upon pollinators for yield, actually getting a crop off of it, or for quality. So those here who deal with food, if you went to the market and you saw a misshapen apple, how much is that going to sell? We as consumers really don't like those things. So having a really nice, big, juicy, ripe, well-rounded apple brings you the biggest buck. You need a bee to do that. In terms of value, we see that 23 to 200 to almost $600 billion of our crop production around worldwide is dependent upon pollination. In terms of the environment, we can think out there that some plants have a very tight relationship, that they're specialists. They depend upon having special bees out there. Others are generalists. The honeybee is a real generalist pollinator. If it can get into that flower, get the nectar or the pollen, or figure out how to rob it, so like drill a hole in the side to suck out the nectar, it'll do that. So this is a sort of a generalist flower. I want you to listen to that bee. You just hear it going buzz as she goes from one flower to another flower. This flower is very open. She's not having to do anything special. This next flower here is the penstemon. So its anthers are way up in there. They're tucked down in there. It's very much like what you would see in a tomato flower or this. Listen to the bee. This loop is going to loop here let you to hear this. That's what I want you to hear. It'll come back. One more time. So if you heard that little very different, it's like a tuning fork. She's basically, what she's doing is coming up to the flower. Instead of beating her wings, she's vibrating her body very intensely. She's sonicating the pollen off there. And there's some flowers where it just shoots out and does that. So tomatoes actually depend upon bumblebees much more for their pollination. So if you go to the stores and you see the Utah-grown beautiful tomatoes this time of year, you know, where they're really juicy and ripe, those are from a greenhouse just south of Salt Lake here. My researchers tell me, I haven't gotten to get there myself, it's like 10, 15 acres of just glass and tomatoes growing inside. Inside there, you will not find tomatoes coming up nice and juicy and ripe unless they bring in bees. What they bring in are bumblebees into that greenhouse to do the pollination. So even for tomatoes, we're dependent upon this. So if you're not getting your tomatoes in your garden, you better ask if you got the bees, if you're getting them in there to do this. In terms of food, over the last 5 decades, globally, we've seen increased production of pollinator-dependent crops. The reason for that is if you look at the crops that depend upon pollinators, the foods, it's actually the ones that give us all the great flavor, all the different colors, variety that we like. So we've become, as a world, very dependent upon pollinators for stability in production and livelihoods. The Food and Agriculture Organization even suggests that without pollinators, you would see a loss of political stability in the world. People would be hungry without nutrition, you'd have more wars, etc. As a researcher way back with CCD, we said 1 in 3 bites of food, you have to thank a pollinator. This is probably true for some of the public, but for those of you who love vegetables and fruits and your salads, yes, you probably have to thank them for even more than 1 out of every 3 bites. And I would attest that even the carnivores in here, those of you who like your beef, your steaks, or dairy products, you're going to have to thank a pollinator too. Here in Utah and the western states, one of the crops that's pollinated in a large part is alfalfa. And alfalfa is one of the things that's fed to cows. And there are special varieties out there right now, low lignin, that are fed to cows that you get even greater dairy production, more digestibility. And one of the things that my lab up at Logan grew up out of Utah State was because of alfalfa pollination. Now I'll show you more about that in a little bit. But this is coming out of a report. You can download it if you need to find it, and you send me an email, I'll give you the link to it. It talks about global pollination. And this shows you the number of fraction of plants worldwide that would not have a problem if pollinators disappeared. The rest of us in the darker green, we see this effect. Over here, this sort of reflects what we eat in the United States. On this picture here, how many of you would guess that broccoli and the lettuce over here are dependent upon pollinators? There's no flower, right? But they're wrong, because that seed that plant grew from depended upon a pollinator. So pollination can go way back into our food supply. The only things on here that you could grow without a pollinator would be corn, potatoes, the grains here. Everything else needs a pollinator at some point in the crop production cycle. So for food production, and especially I love the Food Channel and foodies and thinking about how do you do things, you know, this would be a disaster to have this decline there. So back to the carnivores in the room. Alfalfa here in the United States is actually the third largest crop grown in the whole United States, behind corn and soybeans. It may be right there with cotton. Worldwide, we produce seed and we send it all over, showing you where we're growing it here. And way back when, the growers up near Tremonton and even down in Delta, Idaho, and other places realized it wasn't honeybees that were setting seed on the alfalfa here. It was two bees. One of them is native, the alkali bee. The other one was an invasive that showed up way back in the 1940s. It's called the alfalfa leaf-cutting bee. These were the bees doing it. And the reason why they do it so well is this is the alfalfa flower. I'm sorry. It's sitting there sort of cocked like a little pistol. So when the bee shows up, she trips the flower, and you can see the pollen here spraying off. She's coating her body with it. And honeybees don't like getting bopped on top of the head with the pollen as they trip it. So they go in from the side and take the nectar, but don't do the pollination. So this is a real supreme partnership between the flower and the bee here. So the flower gets to seed set, and then that bee's going to take away the pollen and the nectar to take back. These are solitary bees, so she's doing all the work here. For the alfalfa leaf-cutting bee, we have a lot of native species here in Utah as well. You may see this on some of your plants. This bee comes in and she chews out a little circle. And what she's doing with that is not just causing you issues in your garden, but she's taking it back. If she finds a cavity, we create these tubes, these boards with holes punched in them, that they'll find dead twigs and stems out there that they'll do this to. She brings it in and creates a little lining in her cell. And inside that cell, this is an X-ray image that we can see what's going on in there. She puts in the pollen and the nectar and lays an egg in there. The egg hatches and it grows and eats, the larva eats it. Mom's long gone by the time it grows up. She never gets to see mom. Okay. These bees then go through diapause over the winter. And the nice thing about this is that the farmers can manage these. You can buy gallons of bee cells here. And they will put them out, incubate them, put them out in the field. You'll see little boxes along the field, some painted white and blue. Some of them may look otherwise, with these boards in there. And it's the grower here has this intimate relationship. The other bee, the alkali bee, is the native bee. And I think it's rather spectacular here, this metallic little racing stripes that you see on it. She's a different kind of bee. We have a lot of ground nesting bees that you find out. They make their homes down in the ground. She's one of these. So she digs a hole and then digs a tunnel down in there. And in there, she's creating cells down below the ground here. This bee is considered to be extremely valuable. It had been found in Utah. It was used by some of the seed growers. For some reason, it's disappeared, but it's found up in Oregon and Washington. And these fellows up there in the Touche, and I probably said it wrong, Valley, have these large acreages of alfalfa. And they create these bee beds. Some of them are natural. They're extremely valuable. Others, they come in and make. These areas are flooded with salt. And if you're a farmer or a grower or your own gardener, you know that salt and plants don't mix. So these are highly structured to keep the bees over and the salt over here and the plants over there. So just to show you this, whoop. So this whole area out here is full of these. You can begin to see the little hills here, the tunnels. If you look really hard, hopefully at the magnification you see, you'll see these bees ducking down in there. Okay. I asked one of the growers, who does quite well, how much his bee bed was worth to him, because it was a lot of expense and a lot of hard work to put these in. He said he would rather give up his really nice house than one of his bee beds. He considered his bee bed to be worth $1 million to him. So these bees are extremely important for the crop. This is what alfalfa looks like when it sets seed, and inside here would be the individual seeds. We send tons of this out across to other countries. So hopefully I made the case here that bees are extremely important. So it's not only the variety of foods, but it's also many of the micronutrients and the vitamins that we depend upon. And that's especially true for developing countries, like in Africa, where various squash varieties or pumpkins are important because of vitamin A is one of the main nutrients that if you got rid of pollinators, you would have a deficiency worldwide. There are other ones up there too. So we need to ask how healthy our bee populations are. So back, for those of you who didn't know about colony collapse disorder, this occurred right in late 2006. And the beekeeper who had done bees all his entire life, he was a commercial guy, thought he had the best looking bees ever. He went out 2 weeks after he'd last checked on them, and what he saw there befuddled him. He opened up box after box after box. There were no bees there. Or you might have seen the queen and a few workers. There were larvae. They were dead and dying in there because nobody was taking care of them. Pupae, there was honey. All of a sudden, the adult bees had disappeared. So it created this mystery, and of course, the media loved it. The beekeepers didn't. And we learned that it probably had been going on here and there. Beekeepers didn't want to admit that they had this issue because the varroa mite, a parasitic mite, had been causing a lot of problems. And so some of these guys were doing things to their bees that would be like illicit drug use. They're trying any way to kill the mite possible, and some of it was not legal. As part of our research, we went through and eliminated those issues. We actually went under, for those of your researchers, we went under the same guidelines as you would to ask drug addicts what they're doing on this. So the confidentiality there. We coded the operation so none of us could figure out who they were and analyze this. That was not part of the issue. This was a real phenomenon, and it showed up several times. We came back and made several recommendations. One was to feed the bees not only sugar water, but also protein supplements, and it seemed to help. But not as much. The normal average acceptable loss of bees for a year is right around this level here, around 15 or so. And you see this little bar, this gray bar here, increasing. This comes from a survey. This shows a creeping as things are getting worse. The beekeepers say, well, yeah, I would used to say 1 out of 10 colonies dying was acceptable to me. Now I'm going to tell you that 2 out of 10 is acceptable. Beekeepers, there's some back east, like in Pennsylvania, where the losses are 40 to 60%. So this was the average winter loss. And that's when, of course, cold weather sets in and you see bee colonies disappear. But a lot of people are coming forward then, and especially commercial guys, where they had thousands of colonies and saying, wait a minute, you're missing something here. We're seeing bees die in the middle of the summer when they should be going gangbusters, that superorganism building up and doing things. And so this orange bar here shows the annual loss. So up here you look 45% back here, and it's still way up there. So what's happening? These are commercial companies, business owners. How can you withstand that? The only way you can do it with a honeybee colony is if you have a healthy colony, you can split it in half. And the one half without the queen will grow up a new queen. And that's the only way they're doing it, with a lot of increased labor. They're feeding their bees proteins and sugars and trying to control the varroa mite. Varroa mite is a major issue, but they still have this huge loss in here. So a lot of them have become very politically active because seeing what's going on here. At the same time in here, I need to go back, a lot of growers out there for like almonds, like the whole Central Valley is one big almond orchard. Cherry orchards, blueberries out in the northeast and the northwest, both cranberries grew in acreage. The only thing that they had was to bring in honeybees for pollination. Pollination prices suddenly went from $50 a colony to bring it in to do pollination to $150 to up to $250 into almonds. So the whole scenario's changed and how we do ag and create food. So back to the native bees here. One of our most distinguished bees, like I showed you in the video, are the bumblebees. There are lots of bumblebee species in the United States, a lot of native bees here. It's just showing you here. We've been involved in doing surveys back in about 2009, there came out a paper in PNAS saying, we've done the surveys, we've gone back through all these museum collections, we've revisited some of these areas where we found previously bumblebee species that were highly common and very easy to find. We can't find them in those particular areas. The regions were shrinking. And so some of you may have heard this week, it actually happened in January before the inauguration, and then was pulled back, and now it's back again. The first bumblebee species in the United States has now been placed on the Endangered Species Act, the rusty patch bumblebee. It's been found over in this region down through here. Right now it's confined up into this region in very small pockets. And one of my scientists is involved, Jamie Strange, in trying to figure out how can we get the populations to come back again. It's not only that bumblebee, there's five others that are on the have petitions before the U.S. Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife, sorry, to have them be declared as endangered bumblebees. One of those is this bee here. This is a western species that used to be extremely common. If we look here at this pie chart of western bees and how big their populations are, it used to be this big on the map. It's over here now, this blue little sliver. It's greatly shrunk down. It's one of those petitions that are out there. We also have in Hawaii seven new Hylaea species, solitary bees, have been also declared as endangered species. So we know now that, yes, indeed, we have not only honeybees with population losses, but something else is happening with these native bees. And that was part of my decision to come out here to Utah to work on these, because I felt like we were not honeybees, we were doing a lot of work there, but what was going on with these? So reason why figuring out what's going on with native bees is a large part harder to find their nests. So I showed you some of them are down in the ground, in the twigs, etc. Even bumblebees, the queens right now, she's been hanging out in like a little cavity along four field edges or rodent burrows. We have no, my scientists can't go in and tell you this is where you're going to find them. They're out there. She will be coming out now that the weather's getting warmer. She'll be the one starting up and building new colonies. She actually creates little honey pots and lays eggs inside and feeds her bees pollen and nectar. They grow up and develop, and then they take over. They go out and do everything, and she's laying in there. Late in the summer, we'll have gynes, reproductives, come out, males and females. They'll mate. The males, unfortunately, mating's your sole purpose, and that's it. He'll die off. The females will then go in and diapause again. So it's really hard to figure out where these bees are and keep track of them and figure out. Honeybees, you can go to the box and look inside and see what's going on. We also have a hard time figuring out who's who. My two scientists that I have, I can give you probably the names of four people in the United States that can reliably identify bee species. So just figure out who's who is a problem. They're distributed over larger areas, and then each species comes out at different points of time over the season. So there's a lot of issues there. But one of the things that we can say is we think it's the same cause affecting honeybees as these other bees. We call them the four P's that give you the poor pollinator health, a lot of P's. The first one is parasites. So for honeybees, the varroa mite is a major issue. Luckily, it's very specific to honeybees. It's not hopping over to bumblebees and that. We can't blame it. But they have their own mites and their own parasitoids, other insects that like to come in and make life up for them. The next P is one that you may have suspected, pesticides, and I'll tell you a lot more about that. The pathogens are disease organisms, and that's my specialty, so if I hopefully don't wane too fondly or get too carried away. And then the other P, just because we can put a P in front of it, poor nutrition. So I'm going to tell you a little bit. It's not a simple story. It's sort of like cancer or human health issues where you have a lot of factors coming together and they interact with one another. So one of the things that my colleagues back at Penn State came up with is that we need to think about ag as a whole, food production. For if you were a grower or if you took ag classes, you probably heard about integrated pest management where you're going to bring in a lot of different strategies. Pesticides are a key part of that, but they're not, shouldn't be the only thing that you use. You should try to do other things like cultural control, mechanical control, using biological or predators to attack your pest insects out there. So pesticides are essential for crop production. There's a good reason to use them, but we need to think about integrating pest and pollinator management. Do things that are going to benefit your pollinators at the same time. So I'm not going to talk more about parasites and that here, but I'll talk about these other three. First, pesticides. So this is something that you would have seen if you were doing ag a while back, a long time ago, a direct kill. When these pesticides are developed, they have to undergo a registration process evaluation by the Environmental Protection Agency to evaluate how safe are these, how can you use them. And the previous method to ask about bee safety was an acute toxic contact method. So in the past, with a lot of the older chemistries that were out there, we know that bees getting exposed, you would have colonies show up with a lot of dead bees out here with the evidence right there that this is a pesticide issue. This still happens. Those pictures I just showed you right here, this came from this February. One of the commercial beekeepers here in Utah took his bees out to almonds, and it was a very bad year for almonds for weather. It was very wet and that. So the growers felt a demand to go and apply pesticides, including fungicides. Whatever combination was there caused this. So there are these best management practices that we've come up that maybe can help. One of them was to apply late in the evening or even at night. Obviously, this is pretty bright, so might have been part of it. But it still can happen. But the other thing that was a surprise is I had other colleagues at Penn State that stepped forward, and they We knew that these were out there. We had other faculty that developed methods to go in and do pesticide analyses and looking at it. We thought that there were plenty of labs out there we could send samples. And when CCD occurred, we found all of a sudden that many of these analytical labs transitioned to pharmaceuticals. We only found one lab in the United States could do these analyses using GLP, good lab practices. They would get reliable data that EPA and the companies, the ag chemical companies, would look at. Chris Mullen set up the asked for analysis of 187 different active ingredients, the ones that were actually targeting either the insect, the fungus, the herbicides, or some of the others. They looked at metabolites as well. The surprise came when you looked at pollen being brought in by the bees. So like a half a cup of pollen, what we found was that you could have in that half a cup of pollen up to 39 different active ingredients just right there. On average, 6. That was a big surprise because like this is much more prevalent than we ever imagined. And only 7% didn't have anything in them whatsoever. Some of those came out of Idaho, way up where some people like to keep their bees, luckily. where you're not using pesticides. What was the other surprise was it was basically a record of everything that had ever been put out there. So it included organochlorines, things like DDT, that I thought should have been gone back when I was a junior high student. It's still out there and going around. Many of these we knew could be taken up by the plant, were systemic, that they'd be moved through the plant and end up in pollen and nectar. But we didn't expect the whole gamut of things to show up in pollen and nectar. So only 35% of all the pesticides that were looked for were never found. When we went back and did our analyses and asked, what are the factors associated with CCD, though, we can't say that one single compound or even one single class of compounds is associated with these bee kills. One thing that we've done since then, and this created a lot of controversy worldwide. And so many people around the world have been looking at this, both the ag chemicals doing their own research, ag chemical companies doing their own research, and independent researchers doing it. We found that there's surprises here. Fungicides right now are considered to be safe by EPA, that is not causing a problem or an issue. There's no acute toxic when you apply it there. But we find that when the bees eat the fungicide on the pollen, along with insecticides, that they synergize together and somehow you get greater death in some of the cases. So there's evidence out there now that yes, indeed, the pesticides are an issue. EPA's changed their registration. You now have to do a different tiers of exposure. You have to ask, is it lethal to the larvae as they're being growing up? Is there a lethality by consuming it? But they still only evaluate one chemical at a time, because otherwise, if you do the math, it becomes a huge problem, an issue. You'd never get through this. We also see that they interact with diseases. The other bad news, it's not just the active ingredient. So if you, as a homeowner, or if you were a grower, went and bought a pesticide off the shelf, and you look at the label, you'd see that the active ingredient is actually a very small part of what's in that bag or that jug. It's usually up to 3% active ingredient. The rest is 97% of other, says, inert chemicals. That's called the formulation, things that they mixed in there to make it work better for different reasons or have different activities. Right now in the United States, what's that other 97% are is a trade secret. Even researchers, and Chris Mullen has done his doggone best to try to figure out what are those other chemicals that are in there. We can't figure that out. We don't know. There are other things, though, that are added when they do these sprays, when they do tank mixing. And they're called spray adjuvants. One of these is an organosilicones. This is the chemical structure here. There's nothing like it out there in nature. This is entirely man-made chemical. These chemicals were developed in the 1970s, but the use of them has greatly increased over the last 10 years. These are widely used in ag, not only in things like almonds, but every other crop out there. They're used in turf grass. They're also used in industrial uses and some personal care products. The amount that these are used in dwarfs any active ingredient that's out there. So this shows you what the use has increased since 2001 in almonds. But this is just one particular type of these, not all the formulants out there. Chris Mullen had done experiments. So bees, when they leave the colony, go out and they memorize where home is, and they actually create memories, just like we do. They're a good model system to look at learning and neurological aspects. We know that these compounds affect bee learning and memory, that it's somehow having that issue. We also know that they can be toxic to the adult bees. We did an experiment to ask what happens with larvae, and I'll show you the results here. And come back to here some of the examples. So our experiment, if it calms down, what we did is we set up in vitro rearing. So we took the larvae out of the colony. Julia Fine, who's a grad student, now she's a doctor, did this. She set it up with controls in there where we didn't expose them anything. So you see about 25% mortality here. The purple's good that they lived. They went all the way to adults and emerged. We exposed them to the organosilicones. It's not too bad. We also gave them a little bit of virus. So these viruses are moving through the colony. They're found in the foods that bees feed to one another. You think like why you should never share a water bottle or eat off somebody's plate, because you can get the virus that way. Basically, that's one of the ways that these viruses move about. And then we did the combination here, and that's when we saw the synergism, that we went from 25 to 75% mortality. This virus didn't kill them right away. What happened is it killed them when they were molting, turning into the pupae, and in developing to the adults. These symptoms is what beekeepers describe when they leave almonds. They see all these dead and dying brood in there. The larvae are dying. If we look at the virus here, there are a lot of viruses there, and I'll tell you more about that here. But this one virus is the one that went way up when we added the OSS and the virus together. It's called black and queen cell virus. Back when I started doing work on bee viruses and we had molecular tools to look at it, we had a really hard time finding this virus. Like one colony out of 100, 200. We stopped looking for it that period of time. We came back like 3 or 4 years later and it was like, whoa, what happened? It's everywhere. This virus is now found in 92% of all the honeybee colonies throughout the entire United States. And as I tell you, it's also found in other bees too. We didn't think it was an issue. We can never just say it was causing something. But this is, we think now, a major issue, that it's part of this decline of colonies, why they can't build their numbers up, because they're losing the developing bees. The other thing that we saw is we looked at a gene here. It's called 18-valent. It's a homolog of the Toll pathway, for those of you who are medically oriented. Toll is part of a pathway that is involved in immunity. It's conserved between insects and ourselves. And in ourselves, we also use one of these genes to defend against RNA viruses. We see that it's turned on when we expose the bees to the virus alone, but it's shut down when we have the OSS there. So it's somehow shutting off or preventing the immune response. These are not only a problem for honeybees, we've also fed it to adult bumblebees, and we see that we get this nice increase with concentration. So this is parts per million, and some of you are going, wow, that's really high, until I tell you, if you look at the instructions on how they use these are applied in the tank when they mix it up at concentrations of 350 parts per million to 5,000 parts per million. And on some crops, like turf grass, it can go up to 1% to 5% in that concentration. So that's another whole order of magnitude higher. This is well within the concentrations that the bees might be exposed to. We're developing assays right now to actually ask, what are they seeing? What's being coming in on the pollen? So we do think that pesticides are part of the issue and they're things that we need to look at. For the viruses, we know that these viruses can move around. They've increased in prevalence in amounts over time. Within the colony, they basically have every route of transmission you can think of, going from mom to child, or vertical transmission through all the foods. It can be sexually transmitted. We tell our beekeepers, the queen breeders, teach their bees safe sex. That's a joke. But we also found that there's a fecal-oral transmission. Somehow these end up on the flowers, and it can go very quickly from one colony to another colony. We've seen it in 2 weeks in some of our experiments. But we also see that this is a route of transmission between these other species. If we look at viruses like deformed wing virus and honeybees and one of these other bees, they're exactly the same virus genetically. And the reason we think that's important is you can have very intense interactions on a flower. There's at least 7 different species of pollinators on this flower. So this is all mixing about. So it's not only viruses that can go on the flower, but there's protozoan pathogens and fungal pathogens that affect bees. And so I told you before that bumblebees are used to pollinate in greenhouses. Right now, the only bumblebee that was out there was an eastern species. And we know that somehow it had gotten a parasite, these commercial colonies. There's 2 companies that make these and sell them throughout the United States. So one of my researchers, Jamie Strange, has been looking at, if you have bumblebees in a greenhouse, can they get out through little cracks and crevices? Bees are really wily and they really learn how to do this very quickly. So he marked them with dyes, these guys with pink and these guys with yellow, and then had different colors of feeders with Mark II to ask about bees. And basically what we find is that yes, the bees can move around. So just to show you here, the bees marked with pink, we see pink showing out in these colonies out here, that these bees are getting out, moving over to this. This colored feeder that out here, the orange, is getting brought back in. So there's movement back and in and forth. And then we see these colored sugars moving around. This was all the honeybees coming in and bumping in onto the experiment. So we're going to begin asking more about this disease transmission, what that means. Why that's important is since 1930-40, we've had a bee law in place in the United States that prohibited the introduction of honeybees from other countries back in the country. And we know that there are pathogens in other countries, and we know that there are other pest mites out there that would be even cause potential devastation. So this is why we need to keep those laws in place and also to prohibit introduction of other bee species. There are other countries petitioning to bring in bees because of the issue and how much money can be made from pollination. Okay, so to nutrition here, all the bees need this. If we look out there in the ecosystem, you may have areas with large amount of crop, like corn, for instance. Even though it doesn't need pollination, bees will go there and make use of it. There's some people in Europe that claim it actually benefits the corn, increases the amount of seed set that you see out of it. So you can ask what is going to be better, having a meadow here versus the corn. And what we know is, it's just like mom told you. Don't just eat one food. That's not good for you. Same thing for bees. If you have pollens from a lot of different plants, you're a lot better immunity and can defend yourself better. For these solitary bees, pollen is even more important. So Jim came when my other scientists looked at Osmia here, the blue orchard bee. It did it with, there's sunflowers that make pollen and those that don't. So when you're buying your sunflower seed, you need to ask, is this really good for the bees or not? It makes nectar, but there's no pollen there. What does bees need? And what he found was, without that pollen, they didn't make the eggs inside their ovaries. And this pollen's needed right off from the very beginning. So planting out there for bees is really important. This is cropland that's been set aside that we have been planted. It can sustain honeybees as well as these alfalfa leaf cutting bees. So if we go back and ask how these things interact at the genomic level, we can do that. We see that there's a pathway here. It's called the insulin signaling pathway. Bet you didn't know that insects also have insulin in the pathway. And it does come down to, seems like this is a common pathway that all these factors affect. The nutrition, the detoxification or exposure to chemicals, and the immunity or exposure to pathogens. Temperature stress may be also part of this too. Okay, back to some fun stuff here. These other bees are really important, not only for alfalfa that I told you about, but for other things. This is a native bee here to Utah. It's called the Hunt Bumblebee. It's really, really pretty, I think. It's an outstanding, spectacular bumblebee. One of my scientists has figured out how to get this in culture and to send it off to these companies so they can begin to grow it up and sell it out west here so that we prevent this eastern bumblebee potentially escaping and becoming invasive out here in the west. And it does a great job in tomato and tomato production. We've also done work back in almonds. So the blue orchard bee is one that you would find up and down the canyons here in Utah and out in California. It's a solitary bee. It makes its nest in tubes, as I'll show you here in a little bit. Another one of my scientists, Teresa Pitzinger, has shown that if you put blue honeybees and blue orchard bees together in the same orchard at the same stocking rate that you would do honeybees here, you see a synergistic interaction on your crop yield. You're getting a lot more nuts. You get a lot more fruit set in there, suggesting that if the grower could figure out how to manage the crop a little bit better, he'd get even better big bang for his buck. This goes from $900 to $1,400 per acre added profit. So some growers have actually brought this in this year. She's also figured out how to do this sustainably, which is a big issue because up to this point, a lot of these bees were being wild trapped. And there's potential up in some of the national forests in southern Idaho and even national parks where we've seen these trap nests put out there, basically trying to suck these bees in. It was $2 a cocoon, so you can see why it would be attractive to somebody to do this. So she's figured out how to put these boxes out into an orchard, spacing them out even in cherry orchards, putting the little tubes in there. These are the bees filling it up. These bees use mud to make the divisions in here, so putting mud out there is important. She's also developed, found an attractant that you can spray on here so they'll stay there and do their job. And then the last part here is getting available pollen in place. So even in almonds, by planting a wildflower strip along the orchard, it gives them those multifloral pollens they need. The most important thing for the grower, this didn't affect the crop yield whatsoever. And I would put forward that if you were a grower, if you put flowers in here that you could sell for cut flower industry, you'd have another bang for your buck too. So just to finish up here, for food production and the environment, we do have concern for all the bee species, that we need to try to reach out and do things. We do have evidence out there that suggests that pesticides and these other chemicals are part of the issue, and we need to look at how we're using those. Pathogen movement is happening, so keeping the introduction of non-native species down or trying to eliminate is extremely important. And then planting for the bees is important, but we do have hope that these other bees can come in and help. So now that I've given you the downer, what can you do? So plant for the bees. So if you're creating a pollinator garden, think of plants that would bloom all season long, different plants coming on in different points in time. And you could also support or encourage others to do pollinator plantings. There's in the Midwest, for instance, roadside plantings are part of the highway bill to create a corridor going from south to north throughout the United States, not only for bees, but for pollinators like monarchs and that. So even these wildflower strips alongside the road can be important. The other thing if you're doing it is remember to leave areas further homes. So those dead twigs that are hollowed out, you can create these really cool bee hotels out there. And also think about those ground nesting bees. So don't put the landscape cloth down every place. And then lastly, as a homeowner, think about before you use your pesticide, do you really need to use it? And is there a way to use it to protect the bees as well? And these gardens can be incredibly pretty. This is one of my scientist gardens, Jim Kane. And he's actually put out a how-to book there. It can be found through the Extension Publications on Utah State. We also have it on our website. Our website we don't have control over, so I have to tell you it's buried, but you could find it if you're really persistent. But this is, we'll tell you what kind of plants you can put in and how to do it. The nice thing about these, too, this gardening here, it's xeric, so you're going to be using less water. And it's very beautiful, I think. So just to thank the people who do the work, Terry Griswold and Michael Brandstetter are the two systemists up at the lab. Jim Kane does a lot of work on the bee behavior and lifestyle, asking about what the pollen does. Jamie Strange works on bumblebees, and Teresa Pitzinger works on the alfalfa leaf cutting bees and the blue orchard bees, figuring out how to make it. We have a lot of other people that join in that we have to give credit to as well. So with that, thank you for inviting me, and it was my pleasure being here.
Well, thank you, Diana. That was fascinating, and I'm particularly impressed, I think, by your very smooth delivery in the face of a very rugged video presentation here. So, well done. We have about 10 minutes or so that we will open the floor up to questions from the audience. Please raise your hand if you have a question, and Wes or Paul Michael will bring a microphone to you.
Thank you, Diana. That was a really great talk.
Thanks.
Genetically modified crops, there's a lot of scientists, research that's funded by people who wish for certain outcomes, but neonicotinoids were not mentioned in your discussion, and I'm curious to know your take on that. I'm also interested in knowing, with the reduced funding in the budget for USDA and the desire to eliminate EPA, what does that mean for the future of healthy honeybees to pollinate the crops that feed all of us?
Let's tackle the easy part of your question. So GMOs. So there's actually, depending on what aspect you look at GMO, so when you put the Bacillus thuringiensis toxin into the plants, we can actually say that it probably has little or no impact on the bees. You can feed them as much BT of all the different strains in that, and it doesn't seem to impact them whatsoever. It's actually one of the more specific things. So that part of the genetic engineering, I think, is a good thing, that it's more targeting and it's adding to your arsenal. The bad thing is with the neonicotinoids and if you're doing seed treatments. So seed treatment is where they take the seed and then they coat it with the pesticide and a coating on there. And ideally, that coating is going to be very tightly bound to that seed. What was discovered is, and it came out of Purdue, is that some of those seeds, as they're rolling around in the planter, some of this coating was coming off. And these planters were pneumatic, so when they came out, they would do a puff of air to clean it out, and you would see this dust come out and grow across the field. And it was shown, because it affected the researchers' bees that were a long-standing genetic experiment, that was extremely toxic to the bees. There were a lot of kills. And so it's come about now, and there was a consortium formed, and I have to give credit to the ag chemical companies and the seed producers, to figure out how to re-engineer the planters so that you didn't blow this all around, but also to come up with a tighter coating and other lubricants in there. But we also know that some of that pesticide gets taken up by the plant and moved through there, and that it's not breaking down like what they said it was. So it's a case where they're sort of bet hedging without having the pest in hand, and that's where this IPM comes important, to actually maybe not apply that to these seeds and just use it as a naked seed out there. One of the other things that hasn't shown up here, in Pennsylvania, it's much more humid there. And there, I was growing up in Colorado, I'd never seen these slugs, these little mollusks. They're kind of slimy without shells. And they're bad enough, just one here and there. But these guys were coming in fields. So my fellow faculty members showed me these pictures where this red tractor was turning brown. And you look at it, and it's slugs coming out of the field, that the huge just number of slugs showing up. And what it was is that these neonicotinoids were killing the pests, the beetles, that would kill those slugs normally. So when they changed over and got away from the seed coatings, it went away. The harvester now is nice bright red. The slugs are controlled. And the yield went sky high because each of those slugs was eating a ton of the plant material. So yes, neonicotinoids are part of the problem, but they are also good in a way. They shouldn't be totally gotten rid of. There's different ones. So the reason why neonicotinoids are good, took me a long time to say that word, is that they replaced another type of chemistry of pesticides, the organophosphates. Organophosphates were sort of an offshoot of nerve gas. They were, some of them, extremely toxic to both humans and the insects. What they target is a receptor on our nerves that binds acetylcholine. And there's enough difference between the insect receptors and human receptors that they engineered another type of chemistry, these neonicotinoids, that's much more specific for the insect pest receptors than humans. So it decreased mammalian toxicity a great deal. But extremely toxic to the insects. So how you use them needs to be really well considered. There's two of them. One is much more safe for bees than the other. Canada has eliminated or banned one of those, and it wasn't for bees, it was for aquatic crustaceans, so things you love to eat. So the data was there for that, and Europe has considered a ban on those too. So it's something we need to keep in the arsenal, but it's sort of like where you want to be really sure how you're going to use it. So the funding question. Yeah, so the current budget that's been produced, if you go look at it, there's several things slated in there besides arts and humanities. Ag was slated for a 21% reduction in discretionary funds. Food stamps does not follow in that. That's basically would be cutting many of the USDA programs. Forest Service was like, forget them in the budget. EPA was cutting out the guts. So I think you as citizens can voice your concerns, because I think it's extremely important for not only honeybees, but all the bees. But I can't tell you what to do.
So my question was, considering all of the pesticides and other kinds of things that were found in the pollen, do you have the same thing showing up in honey?
In honey?
In honey.
That's a great question. So my colleagues, we were scared what we'd find in honey. Because honey is actually a great food. You know, it's much better for you in terms of the sugar composition than you would have in other things. Honey is liquid-based. The pollen is lipid-based. Pesticides like lipids. They don't like the aqueous environment. So one of the samples, the one with 35 compounds in it, had chemicals in there that exceeded human toxicity. So it got the attention of both EPA and USDA. There's a lab down in North Carolina. It's Gastonia, North Carolina. It's in the American Market Basket Survey, and they do surveys on pesticides in foods that we eat. The surprise was horse meat was in that survey. Honey was not. Honey hadn't been looked at. So now USDA and EPA annually go pull things off the shelf to see what pesticides are there. You can see some detections, but they're extremely, extremely low. So we can still say honey is a great food. Yeah. There's other great things about honey, too, if you want to ask that one.
Are there animals or insects that eat bees or, you know, could kill bees or?
So for honeybees, they do a great job policing their colony. There are some wasps from Asia, a Japanese wasp that comes in and raids. There's some really cool videos out there if you go look for them. The Apis mellifera, which is the bee that we have here, is a real wimp, and it can't defend itself against these. But the Apis cerani, which is the Asiatic honeybee, has incredible defenses. They let the wasp get inside the colony, and what they then do is they all jump on top of it, create a ball around it, and they uncouple their wings from their muscles, and they jack up the temperature so that they are near their lethal temperature, but they're above the wasp. So they basically cook it to death, which is cool. For our other bees here, there are these parasitoids. So there are other kinds of wasps and bees that do want to come in and make their living there. So that is an issue. And for some of our alfalfa leaf cutting bees, we do have problems that we've started seeing recently with a little tiny parasitoid that's really caused a major. So these guys, and they're very good growers and beekeepers, have their bees there and they think they're doing great. They bring them out and put in their incubator in these boxes with screens on top. Instead of seeing bees, what they see is this black ooze coming out of these boxes, and it's just tons and tons of these parasites. They lost their bees. It's too late to get new ones in, so they lost their crop too. So yeah, there are things out there that want to make use of bees and take care of them. There's other birds too that love bees. High protein, everything that you should be wanting to eat too. So yeah, there's a lot of things dependent upon these insects in many ways.
Hi. When you mentioned, or in regarding to introducing a new population of bee, was it the blue bonnet, to the spectrum of pollinators that had previously, I guess, been simply the honeybee, you saw a higher production and actual mm-hmm. yield from the crop. I was just curious why that was. Were the honeybees kind of slacking, or what was actually, how were they contributing? And if you varied the spectrum of pollinators even further, have any experiments been done with that? And
so there's other crops, that's a great question. There's other crops where it's been shown that the more bees you have, there are more species, the more pollination you get. So back east in the apple growing region in Pennsylvania, they lost their ability to bring in honeybees, and there weren't just colonies to be brought in. There the apple orchards have woodlots growing around them, natural woodlots. And what they've discovered now is all these other bees are flying in from these woodlots and doing the pollination. The native bees can do it on their own if they can be there. If there's ways for them to make their living, you know, homes and that, and other flowers, they're perfectly happy. The problem in almonds, and if you ever go look at a picture of an almond orchard, it's basically trees, and that's it. There's not even ground cover underneath those trees. It's scorched earth. And so there's nothing there for the other bee species to live on and stuff. So here we're bringing the bees in. You're introducing the blue orchard bees. They're not going to stay out there all the time. But if they could reconstitute and get, you know, other plants in there, like even hedgerows and woodrows, potential is that they could, you know, build it up even greater. So yes, there is this synergy that can go between these species. It doesn't have to be antagonistic.
We have time for one last question right here, Diane.
Are bees cannibals?
Are bees cannibals? So if we look at these solitary bees, no, they're not cannibals. They won't eat each other. If you look at honeybees, you have to think of them as being superorganism, okay? So it's the colony as a whole. And it'd be like if you had an infection in dead and dying tissue, you don't want to keep it there. You might want to cut it out and get rid of it to help control, keep the rest of you being healthy. Like you don't want gangrene to spread. And for honeybees, if they have dead and dying larvae or pupae, they're going to rip them out. They won't eat them necessarily, but they're pretty mercifulless. You don't want to be a sick bee in a colony. You're out of there. But there are other insects that are indeed cannibals. If they're too crowded, don't have other things to eat, they will eat it. But honeybees will not chew up their young. They're more apt to get up and move out and move off to some other place if things are that bad. So they do have good qualities.
Thank you, Diana.
Thank you.
Well, before we close this evening, just a few final announcements. First, if you would like to hear Diana's lecture again, it'll be broadcast on KCPW 88.3 FM on Friday, March 31st at 10 a.m. and again at 8 p.m. And the lecture will also be available as a podcast at kcpw.org. Please join us again on Tuesday, April 11th, as we host our keynote and final speaker in this year's lecture series, Andrew Zimmern, TV personality, chef, food writer, teacher, and 3 times James Beard Award winner. Andrew Zimmern is widely regarded as one of the most knowledgeable personalities in the food world. He'll be at Kingsbury Hall for what will be a really fabulous evening exploring the way in which we live our lives through food and how we might better understand what and how we eat to imagine brighter futures. Seats for the keynote lecture with Andrew are on sale now. And for more information or to purchase tickets, you can visit our website at nhmu.utah.edu. Finally, on your way out tonight, please stop at the table out front and pick up a flyer from our friends at Slow Food Utah about their annual Honeybee Festival, which is coming up in June. So that's it. One last thank you for Diana. Have a great evening.